Hey there, everyone. Welcome to Talk Kidney to Me, your new go-to podcast for all things kidney. We're excited to share this space with you. Whether you or a loved one received a kidney disease diagnosis, you work in the space, or you want to know more about this unique area in healthcare.
Millions have kidney disease, but many don't even know it. We're here to change that.
That's right, Pesh. And the most common causes of kidney disease are diabetes and high blood pressure, which affect more than half of the folks in the U.S. So everyone should be interested in kidney talk. But despite these numbers, kidney disease doesn't get the same attention as other chronic illnesses.
Talk Kidney to Me wants to help change that, featuring the two of us as co-hosts, Sarah Eve, the Kidney Care Pro, and me, Pesh Patel, the transplant recipient who started A Kidney Life. We'll have guests from the kidney community and beyond. Join us for a fun and informative 30 minutes. From nutrition and wellness to exciting innovation, no topic is off limits.
Together, we're bringing awareness, education, and a whole lot of inspiration to the kidney community. All right, here we go. Talk Kidney to Me.
It's your boy, Pesh.
Hey, it's Sarah Eve.
Sarah Eve, how are you doing on this beautiful Wednesday?
Oh, it's not about me today. It's about somebody else, their birthday boy.
Yeah, you know, I think as we get older, it just turns into another day because we lie to ourselves that we are getting older. Ideally, I'm getting wiser also. I'm not too sure about that, but I guess we'll go with it.
Hey, every day is a reason to celebrate. Every morning I wake up, I think, wow, how amazing that my whole body worked overnight. So I hope you celebrate this day, and I hope you have many, many, many more.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Of course. All right, let's get down to business. In today's episode of Talk Kidney to Me, we are in episode 2 of a series of 30,000-foot overviews of major topic areas in kidney care. We are calling these the State of episodes. Last week, we talked about transplant. Today, it's dialysis.
I'm going to be honest with you. I was in dialysis for 15 months, but I don't remember much about it at all. I blocked it out. It's pretty traumatic. I hated it, and I'm sure there might have been good moments. I just don't remember them. So I am excited to listen and learn today and to get that 30,000-foot overview and to maybe get a different perspective than what I have in my mind currently.
Sure. That's interesting, Pesh, that you black it out. I have just the opposite. I worked in dialysis and it was my whole world. And I was always shocked when people didn't know about dialysis because that was everything to me. So I think this episode is good for everyone's awareness.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I know that there are more people on dialysis than are transplanted.
True.
And that a small percentage of the U.S. population that's on dialysis, but it's a big spend on healthcare.
Also
and I know
true.
Personally, yeah, and I know personally that it takes a whole care team and a lot of time and energy to be a patient on dialysis.
For sure. So I'm going to say, you know, I know we appreciate plain speak here. So I'm going to start with just a light overview of some things we're going to talk about, not too much jargon, but it is good to know just kind of level set around dialysis. So dialysis it takes the place of the kidneys, which is the filtering that the kidneys would do. Everything else the kidneys do, we achieve with meds, right? So the dialysis removes waste products and excess fluid. There's three basic flavors for dialysis with some variations. So we have in-center hemodialysis. So that uses a blood line to remove that waste and fluid. And that's done at a center with nurses and techs. And then there's home hemodialysis. Same procedure, slightly different machine, but you do it at home without professional staff. Again, there's some flavors, but predominantly you do it at home by yourself. And there's peritoneal dialysis. Usually we call this the tube in the belly dialysis, right? And we use a solution in your body's abdominal cavity to remove that extra waste and fluid. About 80 to 85% of folks in the U.S. receive in-center. So when we say dialysis, often the default is in-center. I'd also add that about that ESRD is unique in that Medicare becomes the primary payer of benefits after a 30-month period. So we essentially do have universal health care for this one condition. And I would say there's about 700,000 folks in the U.S. that currently have end-stage renal disease, with about 500,000 of them on some kind of dialysis. And I'm just excited about our guest today. I'm on the American Association of Kidney Patients Board of Directors with her, and I know you're going to love her.
And that brings us to our guest today. Dr. Janice Lee is a professor of medicine, the chief medical director of Emory University Dialysis, and has shown award-winning dedication to the field of kidney disease. With numerous publications, committee appointments, and speaking engagements, Dr. Lee is nationally renowned expert in hypertension. And with all that, she maintains clinical practice based at Emory University Hospital, Midtown, and lectures to students and residents. Just an all-round brilliant doctor and person. Dr. Lee, welcome to Talk Kidney to Me. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction.
Welcome, Dr. Lee.
So we've talked a little bit about you, given an overview, but we'd love to hear your why. Why did you get into kidney care?
Well, you know, when I was rotating as an intern in internal medicine and I rotated on the kidney services, it really intrigued me, and specifically about dialysis. I mean, I just thought whoever created dialysis, it was a short of a miracle, really, how patients could be so sick and in a matter of a few hours, their blood is cleansed, they're back to, you know, routine activities, et cetera. So the science of it really intrigued me. The just the comprehensiveness of taking care of kidney patients, because the kidney affects everything in the body practically. You develop really close relationships with the patients, especially those on dialysis, because they have to come to dialysis 3 days a week. So they're like family to you, and they're my patients are like family to me. And then the last reason was that I noticed, you know, as I was taking care of patients, that the kidney, that there was disparities around minority patients, that they had higher rates of kidney failure. And that really stimulated my interest to do research. And I've dedicated most of my career to trying to figure out why this disease affects minority populations disproportionately.
Thanks for sharing that, Dr. Lee. I always love to hear the stories behind the careers. You know, I definitely hear, you know, with your story, a part of, right, this fascinated your brain and your intellect, but also, right, followed up with the compassion and relationships and, you know, those disparities. I think when you see those things and feel passionate, it's just such a gift to share that back with the world through your profession. So thank you so much. So we're going to start today. These are overview episodes. And so today we're talking about dialysis. So I was hoping that you could just give us like a description of the recent past. So what's led us to where we are today? Who are the major industry players? What's been driving growth? And, you know, maybe how federal regs have shaped dialysis in America. How do we get to where we are?
Sure. Well, you know, just briefly, historically, I think dialysis in some form started back in the 1940s with individual nephrologists or physician scientists who helped to create the dialysis machine and vascular access. However, in those days, the technology was very primitive. Only a select few patients could actually receive dialysis. But in 1972 is when Medicare came into play as far as funding patients who needed dialysis. Interestingly, before really Medicare started coverage for dialysis, again, it was a select few patients who actually received it. And at that time, most of the patients, or a larger proportion of patients, were on home dialysis. Mm-hmm. And then there was a shift once Medicare coverage started, then it became more of an in-center dialysis landscape, and thus the major players. So, of course, federal government, the policymakers, the insurance payers, and then the development of these large dialysis organizations that take care of the majority of the patients on dialysis. Right. And of course, over time, you know, there's been more involvement with other important stakeholders, like other dialysis organizations, kidney advocacy groups, et cetera, and of course, nephrologists in the field. So it's kind of been a mixture of all these different players to actually get to where we are today. You know, as far as where we are with dialysis and what the future holds for dialysis. And I think you had it in another question about some of the other policy changes over time, such as the payment prospective payment system in 2011 that increased incentives for home dialysis, especially peritoneal dialysis. And we did see an uptake in patients on home dialysis when that system came into place. The Kidney Health Initiative started in 2012, and that was a development of a consortium that focused on innovation and safety measures for dialysis patients. And then most recently in 2019, the executive order advancing American kidney health was signed, and that really started a focus more on reimbursement for things like education about CKD and modalities, more reimbursement for home dialysis and transplant, and in support of really more innovative therapies such as development of the artificial kidney, et cetera. Now, with that said, of course, this was in 2019, because I know everyone wants to know, have we seen any changes since this started?
I'll interject with pretty aggressive goals that by 2025, 80% of incident patients are on home dialysis or transplanted.
Right, right.
We're two of the big goals, and we're in 2024.
Yes, and it's been, I think, in general, I think the concept is great, and I think it's good for us to push for home, but the actual application and success of that, I don't think we're there yet. Certainly, you know, I said 2019. What happened in 2020, right? COVID, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, I believe, you know, has impacted everything in healthcare, including dialysis, in a major way, you know, as far as really following through and being able to promote any of these ideas as far as improving home dialysis, et cetera, especially because of the staff shortages that were put into play with COVID.
And bringing us to present day, let's talk about the current state of dialysis. Doctor, how are we doing? Clinical outcomes, survival, innovation. What is your view on how things are going today?
So today, I think we've definitely made some advances. We are improving our technology. We have different and easier to use home technology, although we still need more improvement and advancement and easier to use than what we have currently. We have some online platforms now where patients can enter their treatment data and it be completely web-based instead of having to handwrite charts or flow sheets for home therapies. Unfortunately, in-center, we haven't seen as much innovation. We have the typical dialysis machines. We have really the same vascular access. We either have AV fistulas, grafts, or perm calves. peritoneal dialysis. There are some newer machines, again, that are enabled and web-based that allow more remote monitoring. But I believe we still have a way to go with improving outcomes. For example, you know, it's known that home dialysis patients usually have a better quality of life. They can have a more flexible schedule. They don't feel as fatigued after, you know, a typical in-center type dialysis session. But when you look at hard outcomes, for example, mortality, it is shown that especially for patients on peritoneal dialysis, their mortality is lessened during the first 2 years compared to an in-center patient. But beyond that, the mortality is really equal. And so the message is that whatever therapy that the patients are on, their outcomes are very similar, except for some sort of patient factors, i.e. how they feel, the quality mm-hmm. of life, et cetera. I do think home therapies offer better blood pressure control, et cetera. They can eat better or eat more because sure. their diet may not be as restricted. But again, the long-term data as far as hard outcomes of mortality are really similar. But the message there to me to focus on is that we have a variety of options for patients. And they need to get the therapy that best suits them. And a lot of times, patients don't have that choice. They are started on in-center dialysis and not really educated properly about home therapies or even referred early enough for transplant evaluation.
Sure. Do you mind if I poke at that a little bit? So, right, the conditions for coverage say that dialysis patients must be educated on home modalities and transplant within that first assessment. You know, so if we're saying that we're not educating them sufficiently, do you think that it's that we're attending to it like a checkbox requirement, or what kind of education would you like to see to really allow people to make a decision? You know, an informed decision, and in-center might be right for them, but to be able to have all of those options clearly laid out and make a choice based on preferences and clinical outcomes, you know, short-term clinical outcomes or what have you, as opposed to a fear or just kind of default that, hey, you know, you're on dialysis, here's your center, here's your catheter, you know.
Sure. Definitely. Absolutely. Ideally, it would be the patients who could be properly educated prior to starting on dialysis or needing to start. That's the optimal flow of care where they are not feeling really sick and have to make a quick, you know, decision sure. about what their therapy will be. They're still functioning well, have mental clarity, and can really look at the options more objectively and decide what's best for them. So most of the time, and what you were referring to with the conditions of coverage, is once they start dialysis, and yes, the dialysis center is supposed to educate about home therapies, but guess what? Those patients are already in center. They, you know, are getting comfortable with staying in center, and it may be a hard sell for them to change once they've already gotten acclimated to being in center. Now, certainly sure. some of those patients, we still can get some patients who've been on in center after they have such a horrible experience and say, I've got to do something else. But ideally, those patients should be prepared ahead of time.
Now, Doctor, you mentioned one of the current drawbacks is people aren't getting worked up for transplant as maybe efficiently as they should. What are some reasons for that?
Well, access to healthcare is one of them. And it's a major one, especially for minority groups, because these patients are getting even referred or seen by nephrologists later in their course of illness. And the ideal time is to refer patients even prior to them starting dialysis. So, because it's a process of getting evaluated, especially for people to find a living donor, that's the optimal type of transplant. And we know that those are harder to find, especially, you know, in minority populations. So, you know, the patients have to be medically suitable for a transplant. And if they start dialysis, we call crash start when they're really ill and have a chronic disease burden, there are some of the medical issues may disqualify them until you know, they're in a better medical state. So really just getting proper access and early access is the key for successful transplantation.
I'd like to maybe, you know, we kind of started where we were, kind of where we are. If we can think a little bit about, you know, the near-term future, the next 5 to 10 years, you know, where do you think dialysis is going as far as, you know, I'm thinking, right, we have the nurse shortage, right? There's a projected nephrologist shortage. You know, I think the duopoly has been shaken a little bit. There's, you know, some changes there. And I also even think about, you know, if we get better, managing CKD pop health, maybe less folks will need dialysis. And then what does that mean for the centers and for the folks who do need it and their access? So maybe just, you know, your thoughts on where we're going in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, those are all excellent points that you raise. Certainly, I think that we need to leverage telehealth more. With our dialysis population. And fortunately, one of the positive things that came out of COVID was access to telemedicine. And yeah. I do think especially, you know, there's clinics in rural areas that are shortage of nephrologists and nurses. And if those patients could be at least remotely seen by nephrologists by via telemedicine, I think that would be a help. I think telemedicine is an important player in the whole future of dialysis and making sure everyone has access. As far as the clinic practices, obviously, you know, we do need nurses to do the treatments. But I do think one of the major things that would help change some of this is if we had policy changes that would allow staff assist home dialysis. Mm-hmm. I think that would be one way to deal with the shortages so that patients get proper training in the home to where, you know, they... You know, of course, the way it is now, you have family members or caregivers that help with the treatment, but oftentimes that's not sufficient and they need more specialized help. And so if we could coordinate more staff assistance into the home, we could get more patients at home. So those are some of the big picture areas that that I think would help. And I think that certainly the reimbursement strategies will need to be continually looked at so that clinics can survive. I mean, you know, during COVID, there was a lot of dialysis clinics that had to close. And that forced, you know, we also lost a lot of patients during COVID too. But as that builds back over time, we're definitely going to have to be innovative in ways to get all these patients cared for with the current, you know, structures that we have. And, you know, my thing is with all the stakeholders, we need all the stakeholders in the room to help solve these problems. including the patients. We need their participation and what they want, what kind of care they want to receive, whether it's in-center or at home, and then help drive the technology that needs to take place in order to meet those needs.
Dr. Lee, when you're at Emory or if you're speaking to other medical students and nursing students, what do you say, speaking of the word drive, to drive them towards nephrology? As Sarah Eve and I have said on multiple occasions, kidneys aren't exactly sexy. So to push people and to drive people to become nephrologists or kidney nurses, what would you say? What is your message?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I hope just through our discussions, my sincere sort of dedication to this field and passion have come out. And that's what I try to instill in my learners and nursing students, that this is a rewarding position to be in, to be able to take care of these very critically ill patients who are dependent on this dialysis machine as a life-sustaining measure. And I remember when I was in medical school and I was listening to the physiology lectures about nephrology, I said, this is too complicated. I'll never do this. But then when I started actually interacting with the patients and saw the needs and saw the science come to fruition and improving the care of the patients, that's what got me involved. Of course, in today's society, you know, a lot of things are driven now, unfortunately, by cost and reimbursement. And so I do believe we need to continue to push for adequate personnel, you know, salaries for taking care of these complex patients. But yeah, that's what I try to, if I had to do it over again, I would still choose.
That's amazing.
Nephrologists are just the best. It always seems like, all due respect, the nerdiest, smartest of the docs, right? The docs are like, no, I don't want to touch nephrology. That's too hard. So you get some of the folks just the biggest, you know, brains, but then also huge hearts, right? Because you're taking care of a group that is so, you know, so in need, and the disparities are there. It always just, you know, nephrologists are just the best. If you don't hear that enough, you know, you guys are, you're just the best, and we just appreciate you.
But thank you so much.
I'm sure the patients, you know, do too.
Now, I bring this to a personal level for a second, doctor. I crashed into dialysis, and I was in center dialysis, and it was hell, for lack of better terminology. And to a point you brought up earlier, my nephrologist would say, hey, we can move you to PD. And I'm like, no, the next time you're going to put a knife to this body is when I have a transplant. So I had, fortunately, I had a living donor. So it was 15 months. Seemed like an eternity at the time. But then fast forward, my transplant rejected in 2021. And sit here today, as of last, my GFR is at 11. And so my nephrologist, every time I see him, it's like, all right, Pesh, let's go ahead and talk about dialysis. And because of my previous experience, my response to him in a very loving way is hell no, because I don't want to experience that again. And I'll figure out whether it's diet, nutrition, or other things that I could potentially do to maintain what I currently have. So for your patients that are like me and are stubborn and also say no because of previous experiences, or maybe there's a stigma attached if they haven't been through it, of what it could be like, what do you say to that? What do you say to people like me who are saying, no, get away from me, I don't want to do this again?
Well, certainly I've had this scenario many times, and you know, my heart goes out to you and others that are in this predicament. What I try to do is advise this as best I can that yes, you know, we're approaching dialysis or, you know, referral for another transplant. Of course, I want to go ahead and do that first before I even talk about dialysis. And then try to do everything that we can, of course, to salvage what function is left, just like you said, really work on your diet. But we know inevitably the dialysis will come if you don't get the preemptive transplant. What, you know, obviously because of your horrible experience in center, certainly I would, you know, encourage you to consider the home therapies. I would personally have you meet with my charge nurse over home dialysis, go through the options with you, peritoneal versus home hemodialysis, get a feel for your lifestyle, what you like to do, like do you like to travel, are you working, what can your schedule accommodate, and try to fit the best plan into your life instead of you changing your whole life, you know, mm-hmm. to do dialysis. And, you know, there's lots of trains of thought about exactly when dialysis needs to start and how aggressive it needs to be. There's something called incremental dialysis. I don't know if you are familiar with that term. But if you start, especially for someone like you who's regularly seeing your doctor and you're monitoring your GFR and you know when, how fast it's getting worse, that you could sort of gently start into dialysis and not do the full, if you're doing in-center, not do the full 3-day-a-week, 3-4-hour treatment, gradually get you started on it. And or if you're doing home with the peritoneal dialysis, not have to do 7 days a week. You could start out with 4 days a week, you know, in advance as needed. I mean, there's lots of things that the nephrologist can do to meet your needs, to make it not such a horrible experience for you. And it's really called developing a life plan. Just sitting down with you, with your plans for your life, what's important to you, and try to fit a dialysis regimen to fit that.
Okay, great. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, it's great to hear, right? The more creative and nuanced approaches to it. Also love the life planning way, right? Which has been recently, you know, took over some care plans, right? Making it be patient directed. So love that. So, you know, we talked about a lot of things. You touched a little bit on equity. We haven't dug into that too much, but maybe we can close with, you know, what is there to be hopeful about in the field of dialysis, right? For providers, for patients, you know, for all of us. And I think we're the general public is kind of more aware of what dialysis is. It's hit the mainstream a couple of times now. You know, what's there to be hopeful about dialysis?
Yes. Well, I do think there is hope for the future. I'm sure you all have heard about the research ongoing with the artificial kidney. And there's a wearable artificial kidney and then an implantable artificial kidney. Neither are ready for prime time, unfortunately. Pesh may not be ready for you just yet. But you know, 5-10 years, maybe we could be talking more realistically about that. I do think there's a lot more attention with all the stakeholders, including policymakers, etc., that there needs to be more innovation in dialysis. And so there's monies going towards that and funding, et cetera, to promote, you know, more research in that, in the kidney space. So that's promising. I do think that involving patients in whatever research projects they are is something that is really becoming more and more emphasized, and I think will help move innovation forward, because it's getting right to the patient to find out what best suits them and what they want. And so those are some of the things. And then, of course, access to transplant and, you know, all of the new research and, you know, some of it's not ready for prime time yet. But again, there is efforts in the transplant space, and where there's been kidneys that thought in the past were not suitable for transplant because of underlying disease processes or infections, and science has developed to where those kidneys are suitable and can be an option for some patients. So I do think there's room for hope in the future. And, you know, the biggest thing, though, I think, is that all of the innovation in medical therapies to slow progression of kidney failure.
Sure.
You know, I mean, medications. Yeah.
Do you think we're going to slow the CKD tsunami, as some have called it?
I think we'll make a dent in it. I don't know if we're going to, you know, make major changes just yet, because I still think we need to tease out all the important factors that are contributing to it. But for example, this is one topic that is related to disparities, mm-hmm. And it's genetic diseases. And there's a particular gene that is now really being shown to account for a large percentage of kidney disease in African American population, and that's the APOL1 mediated kidney disease. And so now there's targeted therapy for that. So that's an exciting development that may help prevent some of those type patients from even needing dialysis. So a lot of excitement, I think, in our future.
Yeah, good to hear. Always like to close on a hopeful
yes.
note, stay in the light.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Lee. It was always a pleasure, you know, to speak with you and to get to know you better, pick your brain. You are the boss. You're just, you know, so just total admiration for all that you've done. And seriously, your dedication to kidney disease, you know, it's just inspiring. And I know inspiring to me, and I'm sure to other folks who one day will walk in your shoes. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, both of you. I've enjoyed it. And I welcome the opportunity to really, you know, talk in this type of setting to where, you know, you can just have a heart to heart with people and tell them what inspires them and, you know, things that they really need to hear that they don't hear when they maybe go to their medical care and physicians, et cetera. So I'm glad to do it. I appreciate the platform and your enthusiasm on the topic.
Thank you so much. And I had blocked out my 15 months of dialysis, so it was good to have you on so that a refresher in dialogue.
Okay. Well, great. I wish you the best.
And thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
This wraps our episode on the state of dialysis. There is so much more here. And having started my career in dialysis, the topic and the folks involved are dear to my heart. So I know we'll come back to it. Join us next week as we continue with our series, kind of working backwards, if you will. Episode 7 is going to focus on the state of equity. Chatting again about where we've been and where we're going. There's so much on this one from an expert specifically in DEI and nephrology. You're going to want to be sure to tune into this one.
This has been Talk Kidney to Me with your hosts, Sarah Eve Schaefer and Pesh Patel. If you're enjoying the show, hit that subscribe button so you'll never miss an episode.
Follow us on social media at Talk Kidney to Me on LinkedIn and Talk Kidney to Me, that's the number two, on Instagram.
We'd love to hear from you. Email us at info@talkkidneytome.com or contact Pesh on LinkedIn or through Instagram at A Kidney Life. Sarah Eve can be reached on LinkedIn or at saraheve.com. Until we talk kidney again, light and love to you all, and thanks for listening.
The Talk Kidney to Me podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional health care services, including the giving of medical advice. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions.